Okay, so we're going to begin a new Masechta, and in fact a new Seder. Seder Nezikin is basically all about Dinim Mominus. Most of it we're going to have, there's 10 Masechtas in it, 8 of them have Gemara, all except for Ovis, all except for Ovis and Adius. Some of them are more, Ovis and Adius don't have Gemara, just Mishnayos, so they're not included in the Dafyemi cycle, but a lot of them have to do with the three Babas have to do with Dinei Mominus. The Baba Kama is really the easiest to characterize. It's about damages, stealing, injuries, that sort of thing. But Matiya and Baba Basra are a little more heterogeneous. There's more all kinds of different business laws in them. Sanhedrin is about the Sanhedrin, so therefore it has a lot to do with Dinei Mominus as well, although also all the Dinei Nefashis are in there as well, all the criminal cases. And the rest of the Masechtas all are kind of, are in a way sort of like appendixes to those Masechtas. Marcus talks about the Dinei of Malchus, Horius talks about cases where the Sanhedrin made a mistake in Halacha, Avodah Zarah, since what's one of the things that's Chayav Misa, then the laws of it have to be dealt with in detail, etc. So the whole Seder is called Nezikin. And in fact, the Gemara tells us, actually, later on, towards the end of the Masechta, we're going to have an opinion of Rabbi Yosef that all the three Babas, Baba Kama, Baba Matiya, and Baba Basra, are actually all sections of one long Masechta called Nezikin. Actually, the Rimi Gash goes even further than that. He understands the Gemara there to be saying that all 10 Masechtas of Nezikin are all considered one long Masechta.
As opposed to,
for example, in the other Sedarim, Zerayim has 11 Masechtas, Moed has 12, etc., And then by and large, you know, each one is considered a Masechta of its own. When it comes to this, there is the possibility that maybe Baba Kama, and literally Baba Kama, Baba Tia, and Baba Basra mean the first gate, the middle gate, and the last gate. So in the sense of like they're gates, like sections of a larger entity, of a larger tractate. Yeah, they actually have written it with Masechta Kalim. Masechta Kalim also consists of, so like this, you have each of the three Babas consists of 10 Prakim. In Masechta Kalim also has 30 Prakim. The Mishnayos of it are just one long thing, but the Tosefta on it is actually divided in the same way. You have Tosefta, Baba Kama, Tosefta Kalim, Baba Kama, Tosefta Kalim, Baba Matiya, and Tosefta Kalim, Baba Basra. So you have a similar division over there of 10 Prakim each of a 30 Perek Masechta. So this could be the same kind of thing also.
Tosefta is what?
Tosefta is the collection of braises that Priya and Raboshia put together that supplement and explain the Mishnah. And most of the time when we want to quote something and sort of turn it up on many times, it's a quotation from Tosefta. From Tosefta. Yeah. So that's Seder Nezikin, and that's an overview of Seder Nezikin in brief. The Rebbe talked about in a couple of times in Sifas that Nezikin, in a way, I mean, it comes from the word Nezik, which means damage, so therefore, more than any of the other parts of Shas, it sort of represents the times of Golos, the damage that we experience in the time of Golos, but ultimately the correction of the damage that we'll have later on in the Masechta. In fact, there's going to be an interesting piece of Agadta later on in the Masechta about the Eibishter says, I caused the Beis Mikdash to be burned down, I'm responsible for rebuilding it, sort of like a Mazik is responsible to pay back the Nezik. So yeah. Okay. So actually, the Zohar, come to think of it, makes a comparison between the three Babas. If you look at the beginning of each of the three Babas, Baba Kama is going to begin with about damages, about four major types of damages. Baba Matiya starts with a case Baba Matiya deals with, among other things, a case of lost object. And Baba Basra deals with cases of, with a case of partners who want to divide up. A courtyard or other property or whatever. So the Zohar makes an association between that and makes an association between that and the pasuk that everyone's explained about it in one of the last tichos, that they sort of represent a progression from uncivilized behavior, as in Baba Kama, where one person is damaging the other's property, to more civilized behavior, as in Baba Matiya, to collegial behavior, like in Baba Basra, where you start off with a shutvin partner. But Matthias, it deals with all kinds of different business laws, but the first two prakim of it deal with lost objects. So deal with lost objects. So it's already, you're talking more on a civilized level. People are returning each other with lost objects and that sort of thing. Yeah. So, or Masechta, Baba Kama, basically the Meiri says you can divide it as follows. The first six parakim of it talk about the various kinds of damages that are caused by a person's possessions, the major four categories that we're going to talk about in our Mishnah, and their various subcategories, as we'll see throughout the Gemara. After that, it talks about the dinim involving theft, involving bodily injuries, where one person harms another one, and the last two parakim deal with robbery. And that's the Masechta in a nutshell. It's not really progression, but yeah, okay. That's the Masechta in a nutshell. And as we go through it, you know, as usual, I mean, a lot of dinim ominous, we have a lot of details of dinim ominous we had already in Ksubos and in Gittin, although those were really more relevant more to things that we're going to find in Bava Matiya and Bava Batra. Bava Kama, in that sense, I guess, is a little more self-contained. There's not necessarily going to be a lot of material in it that we will have had before, except for the short things. And as far as sort of fundamental sugyas in it, there are a few. For example, we're going to have in the second paragraph, we're going to have a fundamental sugya on the concept of zenen evzelechoser. If one person is benefiting from something and another person is not, losing out from it, we'll talk about it. Wait, I'm not going to spoil it. We'll learn about it in the second paragraph, Hashem. We have a sugya towards the end of the Masechta about dina de machos dina, the case of how far does the local governmental law, how far does that have implications in halacha? And in between, and throughout the Masechta, we'll have here and there fundamental concepts like that bear on other places in chapter. Starting out, the Mishnah says, Abar Avos Nezikin, there's four major categories of damages. Asher, an ox, Vahabur, and a pit, Vahamaveh, and Maveh, which the Gemara is going to give us later on Daf Gimel, Daf Dalet, two possibilities of what Maveh is. Either it means an animal chewing and eating things, or it means a person causing damage. Vahever, and fire. Why they listed in this order? Rashi says that it's listing in the order in which they're listed in Parashas Mishpatim, which leads Tosfos into a bunch of questions, because Shur, for example, what the Gemara is going to tell us, that Shur actually includes several different things in it. A Shur can do damage, as the Gemara will tell us, in three fundamental ways. It can gore with its horns, or do other unusual damage like that, as we'll talk about on other days. It can step on things, and it can eat things. And in terms of how they're ordered in the Pasuk, first the Torah talks about the case of a goring ox, then it goes on to other cases. Only later, a few psukim after that, does it return to cases of stepping on things or eating things. So depending on how you understand shur over here, it may be out of order. Okay, but the word shur appears first in the Torah when it's listing these types of damages. Tosfos also deals with the question a lot. Sometimes when the Mishnah did the first Tosfos deals with the question, a lot of times when the Mishnah gives us a list of things, it gives a number, it says they're the things that we're talking about, and it finishes off hain. For example, Abar Rosh Hashanah hain at the beginning, Abar Rosh Hashanah hain at the beginning of Masechta Rosh Hashanah. Why over here is it not Abar, it's Nezikin hain? Tosfos says, okay, it's a big deal. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Different other Mepharshim talk about possibilities, including that maybe hain is when it's an exhaustive list, and here it's not, because the Gemara is going to eventually tell us that there's many others, actually, which are considered subcategories of these. I saw an interesting explanation brought, I think, from Rabbi Lemela Flazhensky, that it uses hain on positive things. Here we're talking about negative things. And then I once saw somebody gave a Purim Torah, it's a well-known Purim Torah on it, that the first one we have on our list is a shur, an ox that goes wild and causes damage. Now, the Gemara tells Sachim that nizha de Torah, the spell, like the word you use to calm down an ox that's going wild, is hain hain. So therefore, if our Mishnah said hain, the ox wouldn't be wild anymore. Okay. It's important about that. On a more serious note, by the way, there's a vote brought from the Baal Shem Tov, and it's also brought, that's also brought from the Zecher Magid, and I don't know who else, that these four, all this music can represent four major areas in that can trip up a person in avodah. Shur is Meloshin Shur, looking, like Ashurenu Velaikarev, so looking at things that you shouldn't. Bur being empty, like a person who lets his time be empty instead of filling it with something useful. Maveh is, again, the Gemara is going to tell us one possibility of mabez, is that it means eating, like when an animal eats produce or whatever, so it refers to problems when a person is too fatigued in eating. And hever, the burning anger of fire, the burning fire of anger. So those four are the four fundamental types of nizikin in a person's avodah.
Quite sure looking.
Because the word sure means an ox, but the word sure, which has the same letter, the word sure means to look, like in the pasuk ashurenu v'leikara. I see it, but not close, right? By sure, right? The Rashi says over there from the Medrash that the girls, the Mitzvah girls, were walking along the walls over there to look at him because he's so handsome. Yeah, so the word sure in Hebrew means to look, gaze. It's a gaze, yeah.
Look at that in
the
popular sense also. Not just the word looking, but looking.
This is also true, yeah. But here we're talking them in terms of Avos Nezikin, yeah. So obviously each one has to be used in the right way. But one more thing before we get back into the Mishnah and then things on a more pshat level is Mefarshim deal with the question a bit, why the Mishnah uses the word Avos Nezikin. Nezikin means damages. These things are mazikin. They're all things that cause damage. Why not Avos Mazikin? And again, they give a lot of different answers. Among them are maybe the Gemara is going to tell us later on that the Tana of our Mishnah was actually a Yerushalmi, so he spoke a different dialect of Lashon Kodesh than we usually find in Mishnayos. Maybe in their dialect, they called Mazikin, they called them Nazikin. So therefore, maybe it should be the Patach, Abar with Nazikin. Different other possibilities. Another one is not all these things are fundamentally Mazikin. An ox is not necessarily a Mazik. If it's mazik, then you have to do something about it, but it's not born a mazik. Same thing with all the other ones. So therefore, you can't call them mazik and as if like that's their whole mitzvah. And then the Tosfos Yom Tov gives one more interesting answer. He says the word nizikin actually kind of includes the mazik and the nizik. Therefore, it comes to teach us, if you are a mazik, you're going to end up being a nizik, because what goes around comes around. Okay. So now the Mishnah says. Yeah, in the positive sense, right. Okay, so now the Mishnah says, okay, so the Torah tells us about all these four types of nizikin. Now, basically, the Mishnah is not really expressing the question, but it's sort of giving the answer without saying the question. Why did the Torah need to tell us all four of them explicitly? Couldn't it have told us one of them, or two of them, whatever, and we'll deduce all the other ones from it? The Mishnah says, Loi harei hasher karei amaveh, the qualities of the sher are not like the qualities of the maveh. Loi harei amaveh karei hasher, and the qualities of the maveh are not like the qualities of the sher. Meaning, you couldn't, if it said sher, for example, again, what sher means, we'll talk about specifically which one it means in the Gemara, then you couldn't have derived maveh from it. Because you'd be able to argue that there's something unique about a sher compared to a maveh and vice versa. And those two which have a living soul in them, a shur, however the definition, means something that an ox does. A mave, regardless whether you use the definition that it means a person doing damage or an animal causing damage by eating, either way, it's a living being. You can't compare that. You can't compare it to fire, which is not a living being. In other words, you could argue, maybe if the Torah had only told us shur and mave, for example, you could argue, okay, you're responsible for anything living. That's in your possession or you yourself or whatever that causes damage, you couldn't necessarily prove fire. And vice versa, if you only had fire, you wouldn't know the other two. The loy zevezesh darkan leilo cholahazik, and all those three, where the normal thing of them is that they travel and cause damage, a shur moves around, a person moves around, a fire moves around, it moves from one place to another. None of those are karei abur, none of those are like the quality of a bur. A burr normally sits in one place. Now, we're going to talk about later, when we get to Toldos of burr, later on, we're going to talk about there are things of burr that are capable of moving around. We're going to talk later in the Masechta about the concept of burr hamitzgalgal. But ordinarily, a burr is something that sits in one place. So again, if you only had those three, you couldn't have known burr from it, and vice versa.
Where's the remit in the Torah? Should it start at all?
It says explicitly, each one of them, there's talking about this. That's the thing. The Mishnah is implying, all of them are explicitly told us in the Torah. The Torah starts off by talking about the case, in Parshas Mishpatim, of an ox that gores. First it talks about the cases of an ox goring a person, where then the ox is chayav mitzvah. We talked briefly about that before. We're going to talk about it mainly at the end of the third parak. After that it talks about one ox killing another ox, goring and killing another ox. Then after a couple of other things in between, it talks about the case where a person lets his animal go in somebody else's field and it eats there or tramples in the field. Hello? or tramples there. After that, or no, in between, sorry, in between the Torah mentions bur, before it gets to that one about letting your animal loose, it mentions bur, ki yiftachish bur, or ki yichrish bur, if a person opens or uncovers a pit, that we'll talk about more in the fourth Torah. Fifth Torah, whatever. And hever, right? After all those, the last one, the Torah talks about is if a person makes a fire and it spreads out of control and ruins somebody else's property. So all four of them is explicit pesukim. Hatzada shava shebehen. So what do all these four others have in common? Shadarkin lahazik. All of them are things that normally can cause damage. There's a reasonable expectation that they can cause damage, or shmiras and alacha, and therefore you are responsible to guard them. And if you didn't, or shehizik, and therefore if it causes damage, chav hamazik, then the mazik becomes obligated, l'shalan tashlumin nezik, to pay a payment for the damage, the meitav ha'aretz, using the best of the land. There's a concept that we talked about briefly in Ksubas, and which we'll talk about more extensively later on in our Masechta, Daf Zayin Daf Ches, that if you're paying with metaltalin, you can pay with anything. You can pay with kesef or shava kesef, money or anything that has monetary value, because it can always be taken someplace and sold. But if you're paying with land, you have to pay with the best quality land. And what we mean by best quality, again, we'll talk about that in a few days' time.
People pay money, but
it's not enough for the but besides that, it doesn't just mean... sure, when we, if we say that, sure, means... You're responsible for guarding yourself. Yeah. Okay, but it's still. If mava means the person causing damages, then what do you mean? What do you mean ushmirat and alacha? Basically, but that's what it means. It means you're responsible for guarding yourself against causing damage. Fine. I mean, a shur doing keren is not darke lahazik either. But after all, a shur does have a keren, and sometimes it goes out of control. In that sense, darke lahazik, in the sense that if you have reason to think that your ox is wild, then you gotta do something about it.
So, from causing damage,
yeah, of course. Why not? Darke lahazik, okay, I don't know. That doesn't mean that it's usual way. It means that it's a commonplace thing. It's a commonplace expected thing that it can cause nezek. I mean, incidentally, by the way, there is a good deal of discussion among Rishonim and Achronim. You know, here we're taking it as a given that the Mishnah is telling us as a given that if you cause damage, you have to pay, and the Torah tells us so. A lot of Rishonim and Achronim discuss the question: what's the actual basis of the Isser to cause somebody else damage? And they talk about maybe it's under the heading of Lifnei Iver, maybe it's under V'Hachalodach Kamocha, maybe it's under Gzela, maybe it's a lot of different possibilities. Including though, also don't forget, you know, we're not just talking about where you deliberately, maliciously did something. You know, even for example, I mean, we're going to learn later on that a type of hezek is, let's say, for example, an animal is walking by in the street and brushes against things and breaks them. You're entitled to walk your animal down the street. There's no issue in it. Nevertheless, though, you're still responsible for the damages that were caused. There's more sorts of. Midkatani ovos. If our Mishnah is saying that there are ovos in Zikin, mitwal de ikatolos. Well, then that implies there must be tolos. There must be subcategories as well. So now the question is, because ovos, fathers, implies that a father is only a person if he has children. Same way, an ov has to have a tolda. So the question then becomes, tolda sen kayot to the hen, or lab kayot to the hen. So those tolos, are they similar to the ovos or not? So Rashi on other days talks about the possibility maybe if we say they're not similar, might mean you don't have to pay for them. A lot of other mafarshim have a problem with that. What do you mean? Why do we think you shouldn't have to pay for the toldos? So the Rif, for example, talks about, he says the question is not whether you should have to pay for them or not. Obviously, you're responsible, you have to pay. But maybe, for example, when it comes to keren, as we will discuss, when it comes to an ox goring or doing other unusual kind of damage like that, we know the Torah tells us the first two times, or three times, whatever, the first two or three times, whatever, that's my focus on that, you only have to pay half damages. And after that, you have to pay full damages. Maybe with the toldos of other things, maybe the same kind of thing. So that's it. Okay. So the Gemara says, let's consider two other cases where we have ovis and toldos and seed. Gabi Shabbos. Now, when it comes to Shabbos, the Mishnah tells us, Ovis Malachas Aboim Chotzer Achas, that the Ovis of the Malachas are 40 minus 1, meaning 39. So, again, Ovis Mitzvah Dikha Toldos. Again, if it says there are Ovis Malachas, implies that there are Toldos. And over there, Toldos saying Kayot Behen. There, the Toldos are like the Ovis. In the sense, loishna of chatas, loishna tolda chatas. Doesn't matter whether you did an av malacha or a tolda. If you did it b'shogeg, you'd still bring a chatas. Let's say, for example, an av malacha, for example, is plowing. A tolda would be, let's say, raking the ground, smooth it out, or whatever. Actually, maybe that would be a tolda, binyan, whatever. The point is, every malacha has toldas. In fact, the Rishami says that every one of the 39 malachas has 39 toldas. Yeah. So the din is, regardless whether you did the av or whether you did the tolda, you're still going to be chayav the same way. And if it's bemezid, chatas if it's b'shogeg, loishna av skila, loishna tolda skila. And the same thing when it comes to bemezid, if there was edim v'asra. Either one is going to get you skila. So then the question becomes, if it's bemezid, it's edim v'asra, yeah.
Both damage?
No, not damage. Shabbat. When it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, if a person deliberately plows, Adim, Wunim, don't plow. If you do, you're going to be Chayav Misa, and he does, he'll be Chayav Misa. And the same thing, if he's smoothing out the dirt or whatever one of the tolders of it, and they warn him, don't do that, then yeah. No, they're Jaredaisa, otherwise it wouldn't be Chayav Skila or Chata, so it'd have to be Jaredaisa. That's the question. My itabin of the tolda. So, what is the actual difference between an ov and a tolda? The difference is nafkamina. The ilu ovit shtei ovis bahad yadadi. Suppose somebody does two ovis malacha, one after the other. Inami shtei toldas bahad yadadi. We just two toldas of two different malachas, one after the other. Mechayev. Then he'll be chayev double. He'll be chayev two chatois, for example. If he, let's say, plowed and planted, he'll be chayev two chatois. If he, let's say, smoothed out the dirt and pruned a tree, both of which are respectively told those of plowing and planting, then he'll also be chayav two chatars.
So,
individually for each one. The ilu of it of the tolda today. However, if he doesn't of along with its tolda of the same malacha, for example, he plows and he smooths out the dirt, then that will only count for one. So that's why it's relevant to know what are the ovis and what are the toldas. Only because you have to know what toldas go under an ov to know where there's no separate chiyuv for them. The Gemara asks, "Kul Rabbi Yezer, what about how does that work?"
We know that because they make they punish strikes in one day.
Because that's what we're saying. Since there were 39 ovis malachas, and the definition of an ov, as the Gemara is going to tell us in a second, the definition of an ov is something that was done in the Mishkan. Then that means if you do an ov and a tolda, it's all under one category. You can't say he broke Shabbos in two different ways. He broke Shabbos in one way that had two components there. Yeah. No, you would need after. Well, you no. In the case we're talking about a chatas, if he's chayav stealer, you can only kill a person once. Okay, the Gemara asks the rule of the Rabbi Eliezer, the Machayev Atolda B'machon Av. Fine, what about a point of Rabbi Eliezer, who holds that if you do an Av as well as a Tolda, you are Chayev to Chatoi? So he doesn't hold the concept of that an Av and a Tolda are considered the same for that purpose. Amai Karele Av, Amai Karele Tolda. Then according to him, why is one called an Av, one called a Tolda? Now, Tosfos does point out, it's still important to point to Rabbi Eliezer to know what the Avos are, in the sense you need to know what to tell him for Hatzorah. Tosfos gives an
example.
No, but you have to tell him what malacha it is. Namely, Tosfos brings from a Gemara in Shabbos that says, for example, if somebody does the malacha of meshamer. Meshamer is that you take wine, for example, and put it into a strainer to strain out the dregs and whatever, so you have clear wine. Now that is a tolda of a malacha. Which malacha? The Gemara, there's machlokes between Rabbah and Rabbeir over there. Is it a tolda of boder, because you're picking out the good, the bad from the good, or is it merakid, because it's sifting? And the Gemara discusses over there the pros and cons, why it should be one versus the other. So on the face of it, even according to Rabbi Eliezer, you should need to know what the others are versus what the toldas are, because if you're going to tell the guy, for example, if he's doing the straining of wine, and you tell him, let's say, don't do the malacha of boder, if you do, you're going to be chayav misa, and the halacha was like Rabbeir, then it wouldn't be a valid hatzorah. Tosfos answers, that's true. But you don't necessarily have to tell him the av malacha per se. If you tell him, don't strain on Shabbos because that's chayav mitzvah, because it's chayav skila, that'll be good enough. We don't know which av it comes from. It doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Is it, you either have to tell him the proper of, or you have to tell him the name of, or you have to tell him the actual tulda, the actual act that he's doing.
If you have one tulda and one of, but they're not corresponding to each other, then it's two punishments.
No. That's what we're saying over here in the Gemara. Wait, we're saying according to Chachamim, again, if you do an av and a tulda, so let's say, for example, according to Rabbah, that straining wine is an example of burr. So let's say you do regular burr. You have, for example, a pile of nuts, let's say, in front of you on the table, and you pick out the shells from the nut meat and then throw the shells away. That would be an example of the malacha of burr. And then, in addition, you also strain wine. According to Rabbah, that's an av and a tulda. According to the Chachamim, you're only going to be chayav one chatas for it. B'mezid, you're going to be chayav one skill anyway, but that doesn't matter. You're going to kill a person once. According to Rabbi Eliezer, you're going to be chayav two chatas. But what we're saying, Tosfos is saying something else. If the person is only doing straining, and you tell him you're doing burr, then fine. According to Rabbah, that's fine. According to Rabbi Zeira, it's not. But if you tell him you're doing the shamu, you're doing this malacha of straining wine, even though that's the name of a tulda rather than the name of an av, that's a good enough hasra. So therefore, it comes out. Again, according to the Yazir, there really doesn't seem to be any reason, any halakhic reason, to know what the definition of an av and a tulda. The answer is okay. So am I kodale av, am I kodale tulda? So why, according to the Yazir, are some things distinguished as always and some as tuldas? The answer is have to have a Mishkan Chashiva, because those things that were done in the Mishkan and therefore are considered significant, important things, kodeh le'av, and they're called av, in recognition of fact. I mean, we learn what the definitions of malachas are from the Mishkan. So therefore, in recognition of that fact, we call them others. Hach the loyav of Mishkan Chashiva, whereas anything that did not take place in the Mishkan is not so important, kodeh le'tulda, and it's called a tulda. So for example, in the Mishkan, they needed to do borer, because in the process of making the ketores or the dyes or whatever, they needed to pick out the bad stuff from the good, so that they have clean plants available to use for their dye works or whatever. They did not need to strain wine. Therefore, doing borer is considered an av, and straining wine is only considered a tulda. But it's true, according to Rabbi Eliezer, there wouldn't be any practical difference between them. Either way, if you did both of them, you'd be chayav two chatos. But they were in token of which ones were actually done in the Mishkan versus not. So far we see that we have one case of avos, namely the case of avos of malachas of Shabbos, where we see that the tulbas are exactly like the avos. Next, gabi tumas. Now, what about when it comes to tumah? The first Mishnah of Masechta Kelim tells us avos tumas. The following are the avos tumas: sheret, a dead sheret, the shichat zera, or semen, the tummy men, and a person who is tummy men, which actually the point, the mess itself is that via voice trauma, it's capable of making a person tummy who then is capable of making other people tummy. So the person who touched the mess is an avatrauma. And the Mishnah continues with a couple of other examples of avatrauma. Now they are told the same lab can use to the hand. Now there, the tools of these are not similar to the original ones. Because an avatruma, any of the three that we just mentioned, as well as a couple of others that the Mishnah mentions over there, are able, this is in Rambam these days, by the way, in Rambam Shlesha Prakim, metame odim v'kelim, is able to be metame people as well as kelim. The ilu toldos, orchon amashkin, metame odim v'kelim, lo metame, whereas the toldos, or vlad, as they're often called throughout Shas, they are only capable of being metame foods and drinks, but not people and kelim. So therefore, we see that the tulbas, for example, you have the mess over here, a person touches him, that person is an avatoma, but if somebody else touches that person, he's only a rish of the toma. At that point, the only thing he can be metame is food and drink, not other people. So therefore, you have the tulba, the second living person, is weaker than the av, the first living person who touched the mess. So we have Shabbos where the ovis and the tulbas are the same. Tumah, where the Ovis and Tulbas are not the same. Hachamai, so now back to our Mishnah when it says, Abba Ovis Nizikin. What is it? Are the Tulbas like the Ovis or not? Amar Papa, depends. Yesh mehen ke yotz behen, yesh mehen lav ke yotz behen. Some of them, no, we said that by Shabbos, all of them are. Right. By Tumah, none of them are. The Papa is saying, when it comes to Nizikin, some of the Tulbas are like the Ovis, and some of them are not like the Ovis. And the Gemara is now going to spend some time trying to figure out exactly what Rapapa means by that. Which ones are Tayyotz Behen and which ones are not. That discussion is going to go all the way until almost the end of Gimel Amud Beis. So the first as an introduction there. The Gemara starts by defining what we're dealing with in our Mishnah. The Arba'ah v'Nezikin of our Mishnah, what does each of them consist of? And each one will deal with what some of the tools are. So, Tana Rabbanan. Gimel Avos Nemer B'Shur. The word Shur in our Mishnah actually includes three different Avos themselves. Hashkeren v'Hashen v'Haregel. A horn, where an animal gores with its horns. Hashen, where it eats things or chews things with its teeth. V'Haregel, or where it steps on things with its feet and breaks them. Okay. First, we've got to figure out where we know each of them from. So start with Keren Menolon. Where do we know the concept of the Nezik of Keren? That's considered an of Nezikin, and that you'd be responsible for it. The Tanan Rabbanan, it's like this. We learn in a Braisa. When the pasuk says Ki Yigach, the pasuk starts by saying that if an animal gores. Now, what is the definition of Yigach? Well, the shoreship is Nogach, Nun Gimel Ches. What does that word mean? The Braisa says Ein Negicha Ela B'Keren. The word Negicha means exclusively goring with the horns. Shenema, as the pasuk says, Vayachlet Tzidkiyah ben Knana Karnei Bazel, as it says, Tzidkiyah ben Knana made for himself iron horns. This is it's a longish story at the end of Melachim Aleph. It's also in Divrei Hayamim. The gist of it is that Ahav was planning to go to war against Aram. There was some territory that Aram had taken away from Ahav's kingdom, and he wanted to win it back. He convinces Yehoshaphat, the king of Yehuda, to go along with him as well. Yehoshaphat tells him, we have to first hear from a Navi whether we're going to be successful or not. 400 Nevi'im gather together, and all of them are saying the exact same thing. Alei v'hatzlach v'nasen Hashem v'yadam melech. Go up, you'll be successful, and Hashem will give them over into the king's hand. And Yehoshaphat gets suspicious. Isn't there a real Navi around here? Why is he suspicious? Actually, the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that towards the end of the 10th... Well, it's fine. There could be 400 Nevi'im. No problem with that. But the Gemara in Sanhedrin, towards the end of Masechta Sanhedrin, there's a sugi over there about the Dinim of Nevuah. I bet you didn't know that Nevuah has Dinim. It does. Lots of them. And among other things, the Gemara points out over there in that connection... Among genuine Nevi'im, no two speak in exactly the same words. Even if you have, the Eved should give the same Nevuah to two different Nevi'im, each of them is going to express it in his own slightly different style. I think I'm going to bring some examples of it from Sukkot. Here you had 400 people saying exactly the same thing. So Yehoshaphat got suspicious. Akitzer, they find there's a true Navi around, Michoihu. Ahav says, I don't like him. He always says bad Nevuahs to me. But they call him in anyway. And he says that actually I saw a Nevuah that implies that Ahab is going to get killed in this battle. And Ahab turns to Yehoshaphat and says, no, I told you so. And then Michoyah tells him a whole thing that he saw on the base in Shamaila. They're judging Ahab, trying to see Ahab has been a terrible Rosha, but on the other hand, he has certain tzchutim. What's going to finally tip the scales? And they said he's going to have to go to his death. So the spirit comes, and Gemara tells us the spirit of Navos, the famous story where Ahab had Navos killed to get his vineyard. So the spirit of Navos comes and says, I want to get back at Ahav. I'm going to go and convince all the Nevi'im with false words that they should all give a Nevuah that he'll be successful. Ahav will fall for it, and then he'll go and he'll get killed in this battle. So now Michal returns to Ahav and says, that's why all these 400 Nevi'im are saying this. Anyway, Ahav didn't listen, he went off to the battle and got killed. Anyway, in the course of the story, the pasuk says, Tzidkiyah ben Knana, who I guess was the ringleader among these 400 Nevi'im, made for himself Karnei Barzel, iron horns, by Yomer, and he said, Koyamar Hashem, thus says Hashem, Ve'ela t'nagach es Aram, with these you will gore Aram and defeat them. It's Mephoshim talk about that. Ramban talks about this a lot in different places, for example, that many times we find among the genuine Nevi'im that the Eibishter would tell them to do some symbolic action, and that makes the Nevuah like more real. It brings it down, L'matam Yassarat Fachim, into our world, and therefore it makes it irrevocable. All the way back by Avraham Avinu, for example, they should tell them to go walk in Eretz Yisrael, Kum Italis Ba'aretz. Yeah, there's many examples of that. So this Tzidkiyah ben Knana figured the same kind of thing. Again, he thought what he had was a genuine Nevuah, but really it was Navos' spirit misleading him. So therefore he figured, okay, well then let's make the Nevuah real by making iron horns. So therefore you see that, anyway, he says, to Naga Hazarom, same shirt as Tiyigach. Therefore you see that horns are associated with Negicha. And then the Braisa continues, and you have another pasuk that expresses this idea. In Moshe's brachas to Shevet Yosef, he says, "B'chor shorei hodoloi," the firstborn of his ox is his glory. "V'kanei re'em kanev," and he has horns like the horns of a re'em, which is a big, powerful animal. "B'hem yinagach amim," With them, he will gore the nation. So again, you see the horns are associated with gore. So before, thus far the Braisa. So now the Gemara asks, why did the Braisa have to bring two psukim? The reason is, because you might argue, you bring a proof from a pasuk in the law. You can't learn from something in Torah to something, you can't learn from something in Nevi'im to something in Torah. The Torah is given to Moshe Rabbeinu. Our Torah is those came off like this. You can't have afterwards where the Nevi'im come and add new halachas or whatever. So you can't use Bechorah, maybe you can't use that. Therefore, Toshma Bechorah Sherei Hadolai, therefore instead you have a positive from Parshas Vezeh Bracha, which is part of the Torah, to prove it. Okay, this isn't a limud. When you say give a Torah, give a Kabbalah, lay off in, and it means, for example, you can't make a greater shavah, let's say, between something in Torah and something in Nevi'im, where you're going to argue there's an extra word here in the Torah, there's an extra word here in Nevi'im, and therefore you're going to learn halachas from it. This isn't learning out like that with one of your Gilmidis. Gilim Milsav Almahu. All it is just giving a definition. You wouldn't know from the word Kiyiga what part of the animal is used for Negicha. And the word, the Pasuk in Nevi'im, in Malachim, just tells us the definition. It's not in a halakhic context or anything. It's just in a story showing that the word Negicha is associated with horns. Gilim Milsav Almahu, the Negicha Bekaran. Lechora, all it's doing is informing us of the fact that the word negicha means goring with the horns. So again, you're back to the question, why can't we just use the pasuk in Malachim? Why did we need the pasuk in Vezeh Bracha as well? That's not the answer. The reason is like this. Ma'u detema, because otherwise you might have thought, keep polygraph monomain if you didn't have the pasuk in Vezeh Bracha. In Vezeh Bracha. If you only have the case of Sidki ben Knana and his iron horn, you would think, keep polygraph monomain tam the mord. When does the Torah make a distinction between a tam and a mord? And again, it does make that distinction that the first two or three times that the animal gores another animal, you only chayv half damage, or for that matter, when it gores a person, you only chayv half damages, and afterwards you chayv full damages, because you should have known, you should have realized this is a wild animal after two or three times, yeah? You would think, hanimili b'tzlusha, you would argue, maybe that distinction is only when the horn is detached. Meaning, Rashi says, let's say you have a loose horn lying around on the floor, on the ground, and the animal picks it up with its teeth and uses it to gore another animal, using it like a tool, which is a very unusual kind of thing. So then you could argue maybe the Torah is saying, look, the first couple of times it happens, look, you couldn't have expected, that's not a normal thing for an animal to do. And after all, Sidki and Kanana's horns are detached, they're iron horns that he made over there. You could argue, though, that maybe if the horns are actually attached to the animal, maybe it's always considered a mord. Maybe you should consider it's always an expectable thing that an animal might gore with its horns, even the first time. Therefore, Tashma B'chor Shari Hadolov, and therefore we need the proof in the Pasuk, and there's a bracha that, and there it's talking about attached horns, B'chor Shari Hadolov, Tanav, and Tanav. This animal that Moshe is comparing Shevet Yosef to has the strength of a shur and the power of the horns of a ra'im, where the horns necessarily are attached to the skull, and it's going to go gore the animal, and it's going to go gore the other nations with it. So therefore we see from that clearly that goring is accomplished also, that kiyigach, going back to the pasuk in Mishpatim, is also referring to attached horns. Regardless then, whether it's attached or detached, either way you would say the same thing. Tam the first couple of times and more after that. Again, in the normal situation you'd have an animal uses its own horns to gore, but you'd have by the same logic. If you were to have an animal that's smart enough that it finds a detached horn and picks it up and starts using it as a weapon, again, the first couple of times it's not an acceptable thing. You'd pay chati nezek for it. After that you'd already be on the hook for nezek shalom. So that establishes where we know the concept of the Nezek of Keren from. Now, told of Keren Mahi, we said each of has tolos. Right. So what are the tolos of the Nezek of Keren? Negifa, if an animal pushes another one. Nishicha, if it bites. Revisa, if it lays down on things. Rashi says, for example, that it saw Kalim and it deliberately went and laid down on them in order to break them, as opposed to Rego, which we talked about before, was just the animal is walking the normal way and it accidentally steps on it. Or Be'ita, or kicking. So those are all told us of Keren, as the Gemara will tell us in a few lines what the logic to consider them.
Is from Keren?
That's what we're going to talk about. Why? Wait. So, first of all, the Gemara asks, Maishna Negicha Dekori Le'av. In that case, if you're defining August of Tulda sort of the way we did with Hilchos Shabbos, that we said that an Av is anything that we find explicitly in the Torah, and a Tulda is anything that we deduce from it. Well then, why are you calling Negicha the Av, Dechtiv Ki Yigach? Okay, because the Pasuk says Ki Yigach, which we just established that Ki Yigach means to gore with the horns. In that case, Negicha Nami, in that case, but you could argue the same thing. Pushing should also be considered an Av of its own. Ksiv Ki Yigach, because after all, the Pasuk says if one animal Yigach, which is the same shoulders as Negicha, another one, then the Torah tells us what the dinim are. So on the face of it, both ki yigach, goring with the horns, and ki yigoif, which we just said means pushing another animal, l'chora, both of them are explicitly said in the pasuk, therefore each of them should be an av of its own. The answer is no. Hai negifa negichi. Actually, when the Torah uses the word ki yigoif over here, it means goring. It doesn't mean that it pushes the other animal. It means that it gores it. Ki yigoif means to push. But here, when it says ki yigoif shor ish, it doesn't mean when one ox pushes the other one, it means when it gores it.
How do we know that?
The Tanya, as we learn in a Braisa, Pasach b'negifa v'sim b'negicha, the Pasach starts off with the word negifa and ends off with negicha, because you have two psukim like this. Some of the Gemaras that we're using have the psukim on side, so you can see. Whoever doesn't, just you'll have to listen outside. The pasuk starts off like this: So yigoif shorish is shoreyu. If one person's ox yigoif, which we said negifa, another one's ox
pushing.
So the braisa told us that negifa means pushing. Rashi actually told us that negifa means pushing. Here we're saying the braisa is telling us that here ki yigoif means to go. And how do we know that? Wait, because the pasuk says, okay, so if one ox yigoif the other one and it dies, and you arrange payment, then the next pasuk continues. Oh, you know that ki shor nag. Or if it was known that this ox is a nagach, that it habitually gores, then you have to pay full damages. So we see the pasuk starts off by talking about kiyig goif, and then in the next pasuk it calls the shur if it's nagach, a habitual gore. So you see the pasuk starts by talking with the word yigoif and continues with the word nagach. Loim alach, zuri negifa, zuri negicha, in order to teach you that negifa and negicha are considered the same thing. That they are four. In other words, not habitual, and the other one is. That both of them mean goring. Right. Both of them mean goring. All it is just first the Torah uses the word kiyigo, which you would think meant pushing, but here we're saying instead of means goring, and then the Torah continues with kiyigo, which definitely means goring. But they're synonyms, in other words. And then the question becomes, Maishna gabe adam nechtiv kiyigo. So in the Braisa, when we said negifa. That's different. Lashon Torah l'chod v'lashon chachamim l'chod. The Torah doesn't always use words in the same way that in Hebrew, the same way that the chachamim do. In Torah terminology, as the Gemara is telling us now, the Braisa, and the Gemara is going to give us the explanation behind it. The word negifa means to gore. In lashon chachamim, it means to push. So when we listed the Toldos over there, we said negifa, it does mean pushing, but in the Torah, it means goring. So then the question becomes, Maishna gabe adam ki yigach, or Maishna gabe behemoth d'chtiv ki yigach. Fine, in that case, why when the Torah starts talking about the din where an ox gores a person and kills him, the Torah starts ki yigach shorish, whereas when it comes to one animal killing the other one, it starts off with ki yigach, which on the face of it, I mean, okay, you're going to say they're synonyms, still ki yigach sounds like a weaker expression. It's sort of like a weaker expression. Nagach, we said, definitely means with horn. Yigoif, on the face of it, can mean any kind of damage, any kind of bite. But you could say, like, the difference is goring versus butting, maybe, sort of. Like, a ki yigach would mean it gores, like it deliberately goes with its horns like that. Ki yigoif would mean, like, it butts another animal with its horns and kills it.
Would it mean with an instrument without an instrument?
No. We didn't say it. No, because, again, since the pasuk by itself continues, oh, you know that ki shor nagachu, then necessarily we know that negifa is a type of negifa as well. The question still is, negifa is kind of a weaker lashon. The reason is, adam de islay mazla, because the difference is a person has mazel. What does mazel mean? Rashi doesn't mean he has das. A person knows how to look out for themselves. This is what we have. A normal person, a regular bar das. Different other places, different other rishonim talk about other possibilities of what mazla means, including that including basically a person is not as easy to kill, basically. In that sense, a person has more mazel than an animal. Also, we talked about at the very end of Kedushin yesterday that mazel can also mean a person's shoresh and neshama, his personal malach, so to speak, that's looking out for him. A person has that; an animal doesn't. So a person has that. Therefore, the Torah says the stronger expression ki yigach, as if to imply like just ki yigach wouldn't be enough to kill a person. Just an animal butting him with its horn wouldn't be enough. You need ki yigach where the animal is really worked up and deliberately goes and then gores. Yeah. Behemoth, less than mazel, whereas an animal does not have mazel in any of those senses. Ksiv ki yigach, so it uses the weaker expression ki yigach, implying like even if it just sort of butted it with its horns, that might be enough to kill it. Yeah. Yeah. And, well, we're not talking about, other mortal oil is talking about a person causing damage. Here we're talking about the person being the victim, or an animal being the victim, as the case may be. Later on in the Masechta, we're going to learn the concept of other mord la'olam. A person is, unlike oxen, which become tam and then later on become mord, a person is always mord. So there's never a concept where a person causes damage even accidentally and they only have to pay half damages or whatever.
It's always
nezek shalom. So, for milsa agav urche kamashvalon, so therefore by that, the pasuk incidentally is telling us a din, by using that terminology, by using ki yigach for people and ki yigoyf for animals, where again ki yigoyf is a weaker expression, we learn from that, demur la'odam av amur la'behema, that suppose you have an ox which is moored for killing people, but for whatever reason it hasn't been put to death, for example there was no edim or whatever, or nowadays when there's no Sanhedrin, having moored la'behema, such an animal is automatically considered moored as far as other animals. So if you have an ox which has gored and killed people three times, and later on it goes and gores an animal and kills it, there's not going to be any dispensation where you didn't know better, you didn't know this was a wild ox, therefore you can get away with chatzi nezek. No, you're paying nezek shalom. So you should have known already from the fact that it attacks people three times that. As opposed to umud l'behemel, I have a umud l'adam, but the reverse is not true. If an ox is umud to kill animals, again, animals don't have mazel, even a lighter blow might be enough to kill them, that doesn't make a umud for people. So therefore, if it then gores a person, then you wouldn't pay kofer. The animal is still going to be chayav mitzvah either way, but you wouldn't pay kofer in particular. Okay. So now we had the list before of four tolders of Karen. So we had negifa, okay, which we just discussed. The second one on the list was neshicha, which is biting. Neshicha tolder of sheni. Isn't biting a tolder of shame? Why are you considering a tolder of Karen? The answer is loy. Shein yeshanola hazeh, because the definition of shein is where the animal has some enjoyment from the hazeh. Classic case of shein, for example, is an animal goes into somebody else's field, let's say, and starts eating the produce over there. So it's enjoying it. It's getting a good meal. Ein hanola hazeh, whereas when one animal bites the other, animals aren't carnivorous. We're not talking about. It doesn't get any nourishment out of it, right? I mean, oxen aren't carnivorous. So if one ox bites the other, he's not biting a chunk out of him and then swallowing it. Yeah, isn't it? What?
Shark?
We're not talking sharks. Come on. We're talking domestic animals, the kind of animals that a person would normally have around. Yeah. Actually, later on, at the end of the parak, we're going to learn that there are certain wild animals that are always considered moored. It doesn't mention sharks over there because people don't keep sharks as pets, but yeah, it's talking about lions, bears, etc. So that's the definition, basically. For something to be considered under shame, the animal has to have hanah from it. For something to be considered under karen, it has to be the animal just does it out of spite, basically, out of anger. Okay. Same thing, revitzo, it's a tool of the regularly. When we said that lying down on things deliberately in order to squash them, or kicking things, are told us of karen. How are they told us of karen? Told us of the regularly. On the face of it, those are told us of regal, so the animal doing it with its feet. And again, the answer is loy regel hazekam matsui, because the definition of regel is that's a common kind of damage. An animal is always walking around, and therefore it's not normal and natural for it to trample things accidentally. Hani ain't hazekam matsui, whereas lying down on things deliberately or kicking are not normal things, and therefore they can't be considered under regel. So far, what we have is the definition of shein is that it's something that the animal enjoys, and later on the Gemara is going to tell us it's also something which is normal and expectable. If an animal normally eats anything that it finds, or not anything, but anything edible that it finds. Regel has to be that it's normal, and that it's normal, again, that's normal for an animal to walk around and accidentally cause damage. Whereas keren has to be. So far we're saying it's not normal, and it's not something that the animal has enough. Okay. So now that we went through all of that, then the question becomes, then what? When Rav Papa says that the tolda, that some of the toldas are not like the others, then what is he referring to? Ilei Mahani, is he referring to these toldas of keren? Can Maishna keren to kavanasa lahazik? What's the difference? Keren is something where the animal intends to cause damage. And the animal is your property. And you're responsible for guarding it. Hani nami. Well, in all these cases also. Why should these toldas be any different than the ab? Just like keren, you pay chati nezek the first two or three times, and then nezek shalom after that, because you couldn't have expected. The same thing with all these other ones. It's not normal for an animal to bite, let's say. So if it starts biting other animals, then the first two or three times is the time, and after that, the more, et cetera. Same thing with all the other ones. So why should it be any different? Ella, so no, you can't say toldos of keren to keren. You have to say necessarily that, yes, logically, all the toldos of keren, all these four toldos that we mentioned, are indeed just like the av of keren. The same rules would apply to them. So fine, let's try out then and say that a papa, when he says there's a distinction between av and toldos, maybe he's referring to shein v'regel. Maybe he's referring to the other two categories that we said that an ox can do, eating things or stepping on things. Okay, so let's talk about those. Shein v'regel hechik sibi. First of all, we've got to figure out where does the Torah tell us about the concept of shein v'regel? The Tanya. This is, we've learned from the following braisa. The pasuk introduces it as follows. Ki yaver ish sada kerem, a person damages somebody else's field or vineyard, the shilachas v'iroi, he lets loose an animal, via this day acher, and the animal destroys or grazes, whatever, in another field, then he has to pay. Meitav sadeh or meitav tamei shalom. So, v'shilach zeharego, when it says v'shilach, that he sends out or lets loose, refers to the word, refers to an animal walking around. And thus we have a pasuk in Yeshaya that uses the shirt of shilach in connection with the feet of an animal. M'shalche regal asher v'achamer. Those who send out, who let loose the feet of the shur and the chamur. The pasuk is actually mentioning in a positive sense, and at the end of the perek, we're going to have the gemara is going to bring a drasha about the deeper meaning of it. But and therefore we see that the shilach refers to an animal walking around with its feet and causing damage. Ovir zuhashen, and when the pasuk continues that it destroys, this refers to that it eats with its teeth. We find a pasuk that says, "Kasher yivar ha-golol ad tumoy," as the golol destroys yivar, same shirt as the veer, ad tumoy until it's finished off, until it's destroyed. What is a golol? Rashi brings two explanations. One is that golol is Malashan gilui, revealed, uncovered. So therefore, it's an appropriate word for the teeth of an animal. Sometimes they're covered when the animal has its mouth closed, and then when it eats, it opens its mouth and they're uncovered. That's one explanation. The hands, the paws of an animal, whatever paws or the front legs of an animal are always revealed. They're not. Yeah, but the gullo would apply according to this. That's something that sometimes is covered and sometimes not. Then Rashi says another explanation, which is gullo can also mean dung, like animal dung. So therefore, how is that produced? By the animal eating. So then the pasuk would mean, kasha yivar ha-golo, like food is consumed and eventually becomes dung, ad tumay, until it's completely gone. So again, we see, therefore, there's an association between yaver and eat. Tosfos brings a third possibility from Rabbi Hanano, which is that golo can also mean marble. And he brings a pasuk, but we bring the pasuk from Ezra, where in Aramaic, marble is called golo. And therefore, the teeth are white and hard, like marble. And therefore, kasha yivar ha-golol tumay would mean as a golol, as a teeth, eat until the thing is consumed. Okay, so there we have the concept of shur, of shein and regel. So, omar ma v'shilach zu ha-regel. Okay, so the braisa said that v'shilach means letting an animal loose and it goes and tramples its feet. So you have to ask, why do we need that pasuk? Why do we need that limud to teach us what v'shilach means? So what are you telling me? Only because you found this pasuk meshalchei regel asher v'chamer, from that you know that meshalchei means that v'shilach means to send out an animal, means an animal walking along, trampling. And if you didn't have that pasuk, what would you think the shilach meant? Ikeren ksiv, ishen ksiv. After all, we know there's only three major kinds of damage that an animal can do. Keren, shen, and regel. Keren is already spoken for, because we had kiyigach, or kiyigoyf, whatever. Shen is already spoken for, because kasha yivar, because uvir. And uvir, we said, means, so what else could the shilach mean by elimination? It has to mean regel. The answer is no, it's true. No, we still need the pasuk, Meshachei Regel Asher Vachamer, because Sakurat Amina Aidi Vaidi Ashen, you might think that maybe the Shilach and Uvir are both talking about a single kind of Nezek, namely where the animal eats things. But the difference would be, Behold Machal Yakarna, Hodaloy Machal Yakarna. The difference might be that there's a difference whether the Keren, whether the principle, the actual thing itself has been completely destroyed versus not. So Rashi gives the example. Let's say, for example, you could argue, again, the pasuk is saying shilach asider uvir b'steach. If we were to assume, and again, we might, without the pasuk meshachei regel asher v'chamer, we might assume the whole pasuk is talking about the damage caused by the animal eating, we might explain it as follows. The shilach asider means that the animal goes into somebody else's field and eats the plants in a plot of land, let's say, but fine, they'll grow back. Whereas the uvir, the steacher, means that it destroys it completely and it'll never grow back until it's replanted. You could argue, maybe the Torah wants to make that distinction. Kamash Malan, and that is why we needed Meshalchei Regel Asher V'Achamer to tell us that no, the Shilach means actual, means a whole different kind of nezek, not a subcategory within Shane. Again, where one way of destroying the plant completely and one not, but rather one's talking about trampling and the other one's talking about eating. Tosfos argues with that explanation of Rashi, which is, Tosfos says, I mean, so what's the logic? Why would you call it, let's say the animal ate the plants, why would you call it loy machal yakarna? The owner, fine, the plants will eventually grow back. Meanwhile, he's losing out, he could have fed these plants to his animals. So therefore, Tosfos explains differently. Let's say, for example, that's the point of Tosfos's question. So therefore, Tosfos gives a different answer. Later on, further down on the Amud, which will be tomorrow, Bez Hashem, we'll talk about that a tolda of Shein, again, Shein being the basic definition of Shein being that the animal gets hanah from it, that it gets pleasure, it gets enjoyment from what it's eating. The toldas of it are other kinds of damage that an animal causes in a way that causes it enjoyment. One of them is, for example, if it makes payrus dirty, you have, let's say, a pile of payrus, and the animal, let's say, rolls around on them and gets them all dirty. That's a tolda of shame.
Because it has hanah
from rolling around on them and scratching its back or whatever on them. So therefore, now in that case, it's loy machal yakarna, because after all, these payrus are not completely, they're still usable. You have to wash them off. There's not really much of a nezik over there. Maybe some of them have gotten squashed. Okay, maybe you can't sell them. Maybe you can't sell them, you know, as fruit anymore. Maybe you have to make jelly out of them instead. Fine, but they're still usable in some sense. In that sense, loy machal yakarna. So again, you might have argued the Torah wants to distinguish between that versus where it destroyed them completely, let's say by eating them. And therefore, again, we have Meshalchei Regel Asher V'Achamer to tell us that not. The Shilach is not a different kind of Shein, but rather a whole different thing better. So the Gemara says, V'hashtad Rukim Na Regel. Fine. If we're going to say that the word Meshilach refers to an animal that tramples with its feet, then taka, how do we know if an animal does not completely damage something by eating it? Again, according to Rashi, it damaged the plants, but they will grow back. Or according to Tosfos, it got them dirty, but you can rinse them off or whatever.
What's the question now?
So the question is, we would have thought that maybe the pasuk itself is drawing that distinction, regardless whether it completely destroyed the plant or whether it only partially destroyed them, you still have to pay. But if we're saying now that that's not the distinction the Torah is making, the Torah is telling us two different types of hezek, where the animal tramples things versus where it eats them, then maybe only chayav ate them in a way where they're completely destroyed, where there's nothing left of them. How do we know a case, for example, like the case Rashi said, where it browsed, it grazed on the plants, but eventually they'll grow back? How do we know you're chayav for that? Shein d'lo mechal yakarna menolon. The answer is Jumi the Regel, because we can argue it's similar to Regel. After all, the pasuk is putting them together in the same pasuk. Therefore, Ma Regel Loshna Machal Yakarna Loshna Loy Machal Yakarna. Now, when it comes to Regel, There's no difference whether when an animal steps on something and damages it. There's no not it grows back, but there's no distinction made whether it's something that it partially or completely damaged. That you'd be high if, let's say, an animal stepped on a keli, regardless whether it shattered it into tiny little fragments or whether it just made one crack in it. Either way, you'd be higher for the amount of damage. Or the same thing with a field, whether it trampled it completely that nothing is going to grow there again, or whether it just trampled the things and you're going to have to, so therefore, afshem loishna mechal, you're kind of loishna loimechal, you're kind of, so therefore, logically, the same thing applies to shame. The Torah is not going to be making such a distinction. We would assume, we will have to assume that shame and the Torah taka include both scenarios.
And therefore, we don't need.
Therefore, we don't need a separate pasuk to tell us both scenarios because you can logically deduce one from the other. Yeah. That's the thing. V'shilach, v'sholach would mean that he actually sends them out. V'shilach literally means that he lets them loose. So all it means is, for example, like he didn't lock the barn door properly and they got out by themselves.
Yeah,
so we're not even talking about that he deliberately set them loose. See, again, with pretty much all of these things that we're talking about, it doesn't matter whether you did them accidentally or on purpose. You're still chayav.
Well,
yeah, that's the thing. Shmiras and halacha. So later on, at the beginning of the sixth parak, primarily, we're going to be talking about it. Each one, not just there. Each of the different ones we'll talk about as we go through. What is the expected kind? What's the expected level of diligence and responsibility that you're supposed to do? What, for example, let's say with fire, the last one in the Mishnah. You know, it can happen you lit a fire, you made sure there's enough empty area around it, and somehow all of a sudden a tornado whips up and then the fire gets spread someplace else. You can't be held responsible for that. So for each one, because we're not talking about something unusual, something so out of the ordinary like that, a total act of God like that, that's completely unexpected. You can't be expected to be chayav for that. So it has to be, for example, again, in the case of a fire, there's rules. You have to make sure there's a certain space around it, et cetera, that sort of thing. So
Beyond that,
same thing with all the other ones. With an animal, for example, you don't have to keep it chained up, let's say. You have to guard it in a reasonable way. So then later on, we'll talk about it at the end of the fourth paragraph. We'll talk about it at the, in the middle of the fifth paragraph when it comes to bird. We'll talk about it in the sixth paragraph when it comes to animals, to the animals in general, yeah.
If you have a field and you have a snake.
Snakes, we're going to learn at the end of the parak, are considered always more, but okay.
So the snake comes and bites, and the person is killed. So who's responsible?
The owner, and he's always responsible. That's the snake.
Because he's always more.
Because a pet snake is always considered more, yeah. Actually, we're going to have, wait till we get to the end of the paragraph, we're going to have an opinion that even if you see a snake, then if you see somebody's pet snake, you can just kill it on sight.
Really?
And we'll learn about it later on in Dr. Zion, yeah. So wait. We'll get there. That's the same thing. Sure.